call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:12 p.m. It is Wednesday, March 18, 2020. Before we begin, I want to thank Madison Jordan May, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Madison Truitt from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phone. Present today, we have Representative Ledoux, Representative Drummond, Representative Stutes, my Vice Chair, Representative Kopp, and myself, Representative Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is confirmation hearings. The speakers referred the following governor's appointments to the Judiciary Committee, and these are nominees to the Alaska Police Standards Council. Members have received applications or resumes for each appointment. The appointees are online and will testify. We will then open. We will now open public testimony. If you're an appointee, because you're on the phone, please make sure you are not on a speakerphone, as the sound quality is not as clear, and it is often difficult to hear what you're saying. And we're going to start with Mr. Mercer. Mr. Mercer, if you are online. Mr. Mercer, are you with us online? No, it looks like Mr. Mercer is not with us online. How about Mr. Weatherly? Daniel Weatherly, are you online?
Yes, good afternoon. I'm here.
Okay, Mr. Weatherly, if you want to proceed, I will give you a little time to make an opening statement, and then we'll see if committee members have any questions.
Okay, thank you, sir. My name is Dan Weatherly. I live in the Anchor Point area. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this evening. This afternoon. It's been an early morning. I sent a brief resume in yesterday via email to all the committee members. I don't have anything to add to that. I can briefly go over it. I spent time growing up in most of the United States and then 3 years overseas in Europe. Graduated from high school and attended college at Briar Cliff in Alaska, correction, Iowa, and University of San Francisco, and then the three campuses of Ketchikan, Anchorage, and Homer for the University of Alaska system. I was in the Coast Guard for 4 years and spent the last 2 years in Ketchikan. And when I got out, I served as the seasonal state park ranger in Ketchikan. And for 2 years, I was also a full-time firefighter on EMT with the Ketchikan Fire Department. I left Ketchikan to join the state troopers. My assignments with the state troopers were the academy at Sitka, patrol in Anchorage, patrol in Valdez during pipeline construction. Returned to Anchorage during statewide investigations with the Criminal Investigation Bureau. After 3 years, I transferred to Kotzebue as a post-supervisor for all the villages in the Nana region. At that time, the Kotzebue post was a two-trooper assignment. While in Kotzebue, I also was a volunteer with the Kotzebue Volunteer Fire Department as an EMT-1 and a firefighter. While stationed in Kotzebue, the village public safety officer program was begun, and I was part of the original group of troopers working to get the program implemented, organized, and functional. During my last year in Kotzebue, we had 10 VPSOs, 3 constables, 1 trooper, and myself. I was involved in the hiring, selection, training, supervision, evaluation of individual VPSOs. My next assignment was post-supervisor in Homer, including the area outside of the Soldovia city limits, villages of Port Graham and Nanwalek, and the 4 Believer Russian villages of Nikolaevsk, Loznesenka, Rasdolna, and Kachemak-Selo. While stationed in Homer, I served on several nonprofit boards, St. John's Catholic Church, Kachemak Nordic Ski Club, Homer Sailing Club, and SNOMAD's Off-Road Highway Vehicle Club. For 4 years, I was the law enforcement representative on the Homer Community Mental Health Board. I was on the City of Homer Commission for a new police station, which is nearing completion. Retired from the state of Alaska after 22 and a half years. Worked for the City of Homer Patrol and a trooper jail contract for 3 years. I then left there and went up to work on the North Slope at the Alpine Camp for 2 years and 8 months as a contract employee from the Air Management Services ConocoPhillips as a weather observer in the Division of the Mini Flight Service Station. Retiring in 2015, my wife and family have lived in Anchor Point since 1983. I have two grown children, both married, oldest living in Fairbanks and the youngest living in Anchor Point. My interest in this job is fairly simple. Most of my time as a trooper was in small communities in rural areas. Lived, worked, and explored and traveled across Alaska from Ketchikan to the North Slope and off the chain to Adak. While with the troopers, I've accumulated approximately 2,000 hours of training, an advanced certificate, and certified instructor in police subjects. The state has invested considerable time and expense in my development as a trooper at that time, and I'd like the opportunity to make a return on that investment. I will try to answer any questions that you may have, and I'd like to thank you for your time and your consideration.
I have one question just to check, because it's not always clear. Are you currently, or have you served any prior terms on the Police Standards Council, or will this be your first term?
This would be my first term.
Okay. Does anyone in the anyone on the committee have questions for Mr. Weatherly? Representative Kopp.
Dan Weatherly, Chuck Kopp here. I'm very pleased to see you putting your name forward, and really your service. I didn't realize you were Coast Guard as well, but it's good to hear your voice, and very pleased to support you on this, sir.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
I don't see any other questions for Mr. Weatherly. Thank you very much for calling in, Mr. Weatherly. You can certainly stay on the line. We're going to be going through two or three other nominees, and then we'll take a vote to move the names on. Next in the queue, we've got Joseph White. Mr. White, are you on the line?
Yes, sir, I am here. Thank you.
You're probably familiar now with the drill. Make sure you're not on a speakerphone, and if you can have a few minutes, or not required, but if you want to make a short statement to the committee, that would be great. And if you want to include in that whether you're currently serving on the Police Standards Council or whether this is your first term.
Sure. My name is Joseph White. I'm currently the Chief of Police in Ketchikan. I'm coming up on my 24th year with the department. I've been the chief for the last 3 years. During that time, I've worked most positions within the police department. I've received thousands of hours of training through different organizations, one of them being the FBI NA back in 2013. I sit on I'm the chair of our local emergency planning commission, sit on domestic violence task force, sexual assault task force here in Ketchikan, try to work unilaterally with other agencies here with that. I am currently sit on the Police Standards Council board. I've been there since May of 2018. What I bring to the board, I think, is good judgment, and I like to listen to all sides of the issue before we make decisions, and the decisions we make have grave consequences for a lot of people. It's a very serious job to maintain the standards of our law enforcement within the state. I enjoy serving with the board members currently there, and I thank you for your time today. If you have any questions.
Questions for Mr. White. Questions for Mr. White. I guess we should say Chief White. I don't see any questions. Thank you very much. And I take it, well, obviously, because you replied, you've enjoyed the service so far.
I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we've got Chief Ed Mercer. Mr. Mercer, you're with us now?
Yes, I am.
And you've probably heard two go through the drill so far, so just make sure we know whether this is your first appointment or whether you've been appointed before, and you can make a introductory statement of whatever length you feel is reasonable.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have been on the Alaska Police Standards Council since the fall of last year. So I have served on the council since then.
But this is your first time up for confirmation?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. You can proceed.
So thank you. Good afternoon. I am Ed Mercer, Chief of Police of the Juneau Police Department. And just a little bit of background on me, I was born and raised in Alaska. I grew up in Sitka, Alaska, and certainly appreciate this opportunity and consideration to serve on this particular board. I've been in law enforcement for 27 years, starting my career at the Sitka Police Department in 1992. I then transferred to the Juneau Police Department in 2000. During my tenure with the Juneau Police Department, I've had many opportunities to advance in my career, working my way through the ranks from officer to chief. I have attended thousands of hours of police training during the course of my career that have included basic police procedures to more advanced supervision management and executive level command school. I hold a Bachelor of Science degree in Criminal Justice from Herzing University, and I graduated. I'm a National FBI Academy graduate. Some of the boards I currently serve on is the Alaska Association Chiefs of Police. I also serve on a working group known as FBI Criminal Justice Information System for the Northwest Working Group. I also serve on our Alaska High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Board and have previously served on several local boards and task force committees in Juneau, local emergency planning committee, and our local homeless task force. Some of the reasons why I enjoy serving on boards and certainly being in our profession in law enforcement is I have a strong purpose to serve. I have a good understanding of police professionalism and accountability. And with my experiences, I think I could share with the board is that I'm a critical thinker and methodical in decision making, because I know that some of the decisions that we make are very impactful to an individual, especially in their livelihood. I have a strong desire to keep our law enforcement profession credible by having uniform standards for all Alaska law enforcement. And again, I can't stress more the accountability. I believe police departments need a system of internal checks and balances to make sure that we uphold these standards. So that are some of the reasons why I feel I'm suited to serve on this board. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm available for questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Mercer? I don't see any. Thank you very much for calling in. Our third nominee is Jennifer Winkleman. We got a communication from her that she was actually under the weather today, and as the day, we hoped she might be able to call in, but she's actually feeling worse as the day's gone on, and we did receive from her some written testimony that was distributed on your desk, and so you should have that. She's not here. I would note that she is a reappointment, and she has served on the currently serving on the board and has been approved previously, and she is somebody that we know because of her work with Department of Corrections, so we see her in the Capitol with some frequency.
Very
so,
nice.
And yeah, so that's what you have on Ms. Winkleman. Does anyone have any, well, actually I should ask, is there anyone in the room that would like to provide testimony about the four nominees to the Alaska Police Standards Council? Hearing and seeing no one and seeing no one online that wishes to testify on this matter, we're going to close the public hearing on the appointments to the Alaska Police Standards Council. Any comments from members of the committee? Representative Drummond. And I'll ask you to make comments to any or all of them.
All of them at once. I'm very impressed with the level of professionalism and experience that these four candidates represent. I didn't add up all the years of experience that they've committed to their jobs in the corrections or in the police area, and I'm really impressed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other comments from members of the committee? Representative Kopp.
Mr. Chairman, I just echo Representative Drummond's comments and would note that Chief Mercer, very dedicated public servant. I see he spent all of his law enforcement time here in Southeast, and I know that I have a very good family reference on him, Mr. Truitt, who works with me. His dad went to school at Mount Edgecombe, which is where Ken's dad was a longtime teacher at. So I hear it on good report. He's not only a good chief here in Juneau, but a good man, very proud to support all these nominees.
Well, and I would just echo the comments that those that have spoken. I think these are outstanding nominees, and glad to see some that have served previously are willing to continue their service, and I think that speaks well. Representative Kopp.
Mr. Chairman, the Judiciary Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointees and recommends that the following names be forwarded to a joint session for consideration: Ed Mercer, Daniel Weatherly, Joseph White, and Jennifer Winkleman to the Alaska Police Standards Council. This does not reflect intent by any of the members to vote for or against this individual during any further sessions for the purposes of confirmation.
Thank you, Representative Kopp. The names will be forwarded to the joint session. As we proceed, please be sure to sign the confirmation committee report, and I believe it's a single report that identifies all four nominees. Our second order of business today is House Bill 174, Minimum Age to Possess Nicotine E-Cigarette Products, sponsored by Representative Knopp. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. Here to introduce the bill is Representative Knopp and his staff, Carrie Crocker. If you'll both please come forward, identify yourselves for the record, and you may begin your remarks.
Chair Clayman, Judiciary Committee members, thank you for hearing the bill. With respect for everybody's time, Rep. Clayman, I'm going to be pretty brief in my opening comments and keep my comments brief, and then I will turn it over to Mr. Crocker to just go through a brief opening statement as well. And with me also is Intemio Harbison. If you have any detailed technical questions, he's done the homework on this. But for committees, just the why and what for are we doing this? As you're aware, federal government last year raised the federal law to 21 from 18 or 19. What I think it used to be 19 nationally. State has always been 19. It used to be 18, I believe, nationally. This federal government raised it to 21. This bill simply raises in compliance, not conforming language essentially, but pretty much brings us into compliance with the federal government, what they've done. And the reason for this is because if we left it as is, there would be discrepancies if somebody sold to somebody under 21 year of age. Federal penalties would apply, but if they sold to somebody under 18 or under 19 years of age, state penalties would apply. And there's that ambiguity between the 20-year-olds and 19, which laws would apply to them. So this simply brings it up. The penalties in state law are not severely harsher, but a little bit more than what the federal guidelines are. So brings us into compliance, just raises the age of 21 and changes nothing else in the bill. And I'll just turn it over to Mr. Crocker briefly. To
Representative Ledoux, do you want to wait till the presentation is done? I mean, if you want to ask Representative Knopp a question, you're certainly welcome.
I was just wondering why it's so important to have our tobacco laws in compliance when we have marijuana laws, which clearly aren't in compliance with the federal laws, and we seem to be living through that.
Well, to the chair, Representative Ledoux, it's important for two reasons. One is apples and oranges in that regard. I mean, the federal government, as you know, doesn't regulate marijuana, doesn't allow it, period. And but the state has allowed it, and the federal government hasn't changed their rules on that. But age limits for the sale of tobacco products is in law, state and federal law. And the reason it is important is that we avoid that conflict between law enforcement and the judicial system. You know, it just keeps it clean. It just cleans it up, as really is what it does. I guess important would be a matter of opinion for some people. You know, what is important? I think it's important as we get through the judiciary process, penalty phase, that we're consistent in what we've adopted as legislators. That's what we're doing. We're staying with what we've adopted over time in state history, and that's why it's important to do that.
Follow up?
A difference of opinion.
Okay. You want to proceed with your presentation?
Carrie Crocker, staff to Representative Knopp. And I could answer that question a little more. One of the important parts about this is that there's about $2.8 million in federal substance abuse grant money that's tied to this age change. So that's important for the state to realize that down the road, if we don't change it, we'll run the risk of losing some of those federal substance abuse grants. HB 174 will change Alaska's statute to match the recently federal implemented guidelines for sale of tobacco products. This bill raised the legal age in Alaska from 19 to 21 and end discrepancies in both statute and enforcement between federal and state tobacco laws. According to the Department of Health and Human Services, smoking costs the state around $575 million in direct medical expenses and kills about 700 people annually in Alaska. The deaths of Alaskans to smoking further cost the state about $261 million yearly in lost productivity. And according to the Alaska Youth Survey, 12% of male youth and 9% of Alaskan female youth use tobacco products. These tobacco products becomes more prevalent the higher the grade level. It starts around 6% in ninth grade and gets to 16% in 12th grade. The increase in the number of youth tobacco users between the freshman and senior year highlights how access to tobacco products leads to the rise in tobacco use. By raising the legal age of tobacco from 19 to 21, we'll further be removing that access. 89% of students who smoke get their tobacco products from a peer. So by doing that, we'll be removing it's important to match the Alaska smoking statutes with federal guidelines in order to allow state law enforcement personnel to prevent and enforce sales to underage consumers. It's the intent of the bill to match Alaska statute with federal guidelines, but to combat tobacco use amongst children.
Thank you. Are there questions either for the bill sponsor or his staff? I would note, in addition to the bill sponsor and his staff, he's got other staff here as well online for questions. Is Christy Knight, Alaska Tobacco Prevention and Control. Joe Darnell, Alaska Tobacco Prevention and Control. Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director, Division of Revenue and Tax. Hold on, I'm just letting you know who's all here so I don't forget. Sharon Walsh, Division of Corporations and Public Licensing. All available. If you have questions, Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I don't know if you have any clue, but I've heard it said that there are a lot of hours wasted by employees or individuals that go outside and smoke or smoke during office hours. Any idea how much time is expended by working people stepping out smoking?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, no, I don't have that information, but I believe it exists.
It does. You can watch it here. It's amazing. I read it somewhere. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kopp, and then I'll get to Representative Drummond.
Chairman.
Representative Kopp.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Knopp, is there any change in the penalties, or is it just to the age eligibility?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, I appreciate that question immensely. It was a point I wanted to make is we looked hard at the penalties to see if there's something we should change, should adopt, but Rep. Kopp, it's exactly the same. Simply raises the ages, no changes in penalties, you know, and we looked at the penalties. We looked at do we want to take this opportunity to advance something, but then were penalties that were adopted over years by many legislators, lawmakers, and seemed to be appropriate, and it was what the public was used to, it's what industry was used to, and we saw no need to change them. So, yes, sir, it's exactly just raising the age limit and nothing else.
Thank you.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought I heard Mr. Crocker say that smoking costs the state $261 million yearly in lost productivity, but that appears to be related to the deaths of Alaskans, who I assume were productive people prior to their death, even though they may have spent a lot of time leaving the building to smoke. I just want to make a comment. I said the states and the federal government coordinated their age level for liquor consumption decades ago. I want to say 40 years ago, 50 years ago, I don't remember where it was, but it was related to highway safety funds, highway safety maintenance and construction funds. All I can say is it's about time. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Through the chair.
Reminder that, Representative Knopp, She didn't have a question, so you don't get to answer.
I'd like to make a brief statement.
We're going to see if there's more questions. Representative will do.
So this prevents somebody who's under the age of 21 from selling tobacco also, correct?
Correct.
Is there any grandfather clause? I mean, you got a lot of kids who are working in, one person, quick stops and so forth, so they're all going to get fired?
No, ma'am. They just have to have somebody to the chair. No, absolutely. They retain their jobs. But just like in a restaurant business, you could have a wait staff bringing you water, food, drinks. But when you need an alcoholic beverage, you have to go get somebody legally to sell that. Same thing applies in the quick stores and the tobacco products.
Gotcha. But sometimes there's only one person in these stores. So how are you going to take care of those people losing their jobs?
Actually, through the chair, Representative, nobody loses a job. There just will be no tobacco sales during that period of underaged people just not allowed to sell tobacco products. And store owners, property owners are aware of that, so they'd have to make them provisions.
Representative Kopp.
Representative Knopf, I see you have an effective date of January 1st, 2021. Is that to provide time for public education about the change in this legislation?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, that way we were able to give the public time to deal with that, the kind of the question that Representative Ledoux just asked, and give the public time to react to the law change in the statute.
Okay, other questions? I don't see any other questions. We do have some people for public hearing, so I'm going to go ahead and open the public hearing on House Bill 174. If you're on the phone, please make sure you're not on a speakerphone, as the sound quality is not as clear and it's often difficult to hear exactly what you're saying. And I will formally ask, is there anyone in the room who would like to provide public testimony? Hearing and seeing no one, I will turn to the people online. The first is John Barrier with Jewel Labs. Mr. Barrier, you have 2 minutes for public comment. Please state your name.
Thank you, Chair, Vice Chair, and committee members. John Barrier here, Senior Director of Public Affairs for Jewel Labs. We've already submitted written testimony for the record in strong support of the proposal to increase the minimum age of purchase for tobacco and vapor products to 21, in line with the recent federal law passed by Congress and signed by the President. I'd like to reiterate Jewel Labs' support for HB 174 and urge the committee and the legislature to pass a clean tobacco 21 bill. Progress in reducing youth vaping, we are a leading manufacturer of closed-system vapor products as an alternative to combustible cigarettes, but progress in reducing youth use of these products will depend on states to ensure that underage sales are halted. And for the new federal law to work appropriately, states should still pass and enforce laws to ensure that retailers only sell to those age 21 and older. Not only is it the right policy to pass as an incentive, as was acknowledged earlier, states that do not adopt strategies to enforce against retailers selling to underage persons risk losing a portion of their federal block grant funding for substance abuse. Our mission at Jewel Labs is to transition the world's 1 billion adult smokers away from combustible cigarettes, and we pursue this mission while actively combating underage use of our products. We believe that raising the minimum age is a critical step in combating underage use of cigarettes, other tobacco products, and vapor products. Nearly 94% of smokers started before age 21, and approximately 80% of underage users access vapor products through social sourcing, which is obtaining tobacco or vapor products from legal age adults, usually an older friend or a sibling. Underage use is antithetical to our mission, and we've taken definitive actions towards restricting it, including voluntarily discontinuing the sale of our flavored products other than tobacco and menthol, restricting sales on our e-commerce platform through industry-leading age verification technology, suspending all advertising and promotion of our products through broadcast media, print, and digital channels, instituting a three strikes policy as part of our secret shopper program, to prohibit retailers from selling Jewel products for at least a year if they incur three violations for either age verification noncompliance or bulk purchasing noncompliance.
Mr. Barry, you're at a little over the two-minute mark. Can you conclude your comments?
Yes. In conclusion, we share a common goal with everyone, I think, that's in the policymaker, regulator, parent realm, that we want to prevent the underage use of these products. And therefore, we respectfully urge the committee and ask the legislature to pass HB 174 as a Clean Tobacco 21 bill.
Thank you very much. I don't see any questions from the committee. Next in the queue, we have Alex McDonald calling from Fairbanks. Mr. McDonald, please state your name and any affiliation you may have. We're limiting public testimony to 2 minutes.
Alex McDonald, Fairbanks, Alaska, and I'm representing myself. I was calling, young adults are taking a huge hit in the state right now. College students were ordered out of the dorms as of yesterday without given an option of a place to live. No word on refunds for meal plans or housing, anything like that. A lot of them are going to be out of jobs with restaurant closures. I know I cooked through college. And we got half the troops in Iraq right now are from Fort Wainwright. And with the DOD travel ban, are they going to be extended over there? I mean, these young adults are fighting for our country. You guys should be hearing bills on how to help them instead of restrict their freedoms during this time and restrict job opportunities for them. I mean, what store is going to hire a 20-year-old that can't perform all the duties at a gas station? I mean, it's absolutely ludicrous. We've got bigger fish to fry right now. Idaho just voted down a similar bill stating that there's a lot of dangerous things in life. War is one of them. We don't question sending an 18, 19, or 20-year-old to war, but we or trust them with maintaining aircraft or machinery, weapons, systems, all that stuff. I mean, these are adults. They should be able to make adult choices as adults. So please focus on the issues facing the state right now. This is not a major issue. People are going to be out of jobs. Tourism's taking a hit. ConocoPhillips just announced they're curtailing activities on the slope. We've got way bigger things to worry about than restricting adults' freedoms.
Anything else?
There's a ton of serious issues we're facing right now. This is like way on the back burner. I don't see why, when businesses don't even know if they're going to be able to be open tomorrow. You know, like we need some sort of reassurance that things are going to continue as normal.
Okay, you're at the 2 minute mark. I'll give you a couple of just a second to wind up.
Yeah, restricting people's freedoms in a time like this is so backwards. I mean, let people live their lives. There's no grandfather date. What are people that are 19 supposed to do?
All right. Thank you very much. Next, any questions? I don't see any questions from Mr. McDonald. Next in the queue is Sean DeSilva. Mr. DeSilva, state your name and any affiliation you may have.
Members, my name is Sean DeSilva. I'm a store owner. I have adult vapor stores located in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Wasilla. And I'm here to testify in support of HB 174. As we know, the federal age was changed fairly recently, and many states are working on legislation or laws to put this forward. As someone who's been on the front line of helping adults stop smoking by using vapor products, we are concerned about youth access. Many underage users have been getting products, again, from social circles, from friends, family that are of the age to be able to purchase, which in Alaska is 19. And we are very supportive of switching that to Tobacco 21 so that we can ensure that youth don't get easy access and make sure that we don't end up creating another problem in the future. So I just wanted to let you know as someone, as a business owner in Alaska who has many, many customers that have stopped smoking, adults that have stopped smoking prior to the age of 21. They talk about that. Some of them as young as 12 or 13 years old. And I think this will be a tremendous step in ensuring that we don't have underage users. And I strongly urge you to pass the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. DeSilva? Hearing and seeing none, thank you very much. Next in the queue, Marge Stoneking calling from Anchorage. Ms. Stoneking, if you can identify yourself, any affiliation you may have, and you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Chair Klayman and members of the committee. This is Marge Stoneking, Executive Director of the American Lung Association in Alaska. And thank you for continuing to serve Alaskans while keeping yourselves and the public safe through public health practices. Our state is facing a current youth e-cigarette epidemic, and as is the nation, and that was identified by the U.S. Surgeon General and the FDA. At that time, raising the minimum sales age for tobacco products to 21 can help save lives and economic damages caused by tobacco use in Alaska. Kids are especially vulnerable to the impacts of vaping, including nicotine addiction, dangers to developing lungs by inhaling the harmful ultrafine particles, heavy metals, and chemicals, and negative brain development impacts of nicotine. And House Bill 174 offers one strategy to safeguard lung health by increasing the state age. And the Lung Association urges your support of this bill. When President Trump signed the spending bill on December 20th, 2019, that included raising the legal age of purchase for all tobacco products nationwide from 18 to 21, that was a major accomplishment for public health and the Lung Association, and our other public health partners cheered that on. At that time, FDA announced that Tobacco 21 took effect at the time the president signed the bill, and there are no exemptions, including for military personnel anywhere in the U.S., nor would the military have supported that, by the way, or on tribal lands. And so the legal age of sales for tobacco products nationwide is 21 years old. Enforcement is handled primarily at the state level, particularly in Alaska.
Ms. Stoneking, you're a little over the two-minute mark. If you could conclude your remarks, that would be great.
Sure. So in 2003, we strengthened our state law, and Alaska has maintained compliance with the requirement that keeps us in compliance for that mental health funding. And in fact, far exceeded that requirement, with only 5% endorsement license holders not passing compliance checks. So in short, our underage enforcement program works effectively, and now the age just needs to be updated from 19 to 21 to reflect the new federal law.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
She's just reading what she wrote.
I don't see any questions. Next in the queue is Emily Ninon.
Hold on.
Did you have a question for Ms. Stone King?
I do, yeah.
Okay, go ahead, Representative Drummond.
Ms. Stone King, thank you for your testimony. I'm not clear on what the SINAR amendment is.
Yes, the SINAR amendment is named after a former member of Congress, and that's that mandate for maintaining a certain level of compliance with federal checks in order to maintain critical federal mental health and substance abuse grant funds that's been mentioned.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. I don't see any other questions. Next in the queue is Emily Ninon. Ms. Ninon, if you would please state your name and any affiliation.
Hi, this is Emily Ninon. I'm the Alaska Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. I want to echo my thanks to Chair Klayman, members of the committee, and all of your colleagues and staff there for maintaining and continuing the work of the state in some very challenging times. I'll keep my comments brief, and that is to state that, yes, we do support this regulatory update in order to match the federal regulations. We, Alaska, is proud of a very successful compliance check program, including vendor education. I know that Joe Darnell, who heads up that program, is on the line if you want to know more details about it. But we have a model program across the state, looking forward to just making this this regulatory change so that we can be in uniformity with federal law. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't see anyone else in the queue that would like to provide public testimony, so I'm going to close public testimony on House Bill 174. Let's take a brief at ease. So while we were off record, I was having a brief conversation with the members of the committee for the public. I was curious to see whether anybody had any amendments they were planning to offer, and it doesn't appear that anyone wants to offer any amendments. And so what I, as chair, am going to do is exercise my authority to waive the second hearing of the committee, and that would bring the bill back before the committee and open this up for comments from members of the committee. Does anyone on the committee want to make comments about this bill? Representative Ledoux.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to imagine. I mean, we live in a society where people at 18, 19 years old, they can go to war. They can get married. They can get divorced. I think they can probably, you know, take flying lessons, and they can skydive. They can be part of the commercial fishing industry, which is probably the most dangerous industry in the world. They can join circuses and be on the trapeze. They can horseback ride. They can do all sorts of things. I mean, so the idea that we have to change our laws just to be in conformance with the federal regulation, which if I were, you know, in another body, I would disagree with the federal regulation, when with respect to marijuana, we're not particularly concerned that we're in sync with the feds. I just really don't understand it. And I think if you listen to a lot of the testimony, that it comes from folks who really would like to say there should be a law that nobody can smoke, period, whether they're 19, 20, 21, or 91. So, but as I say, I can count, so you're going to do what you're going to do.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux. Anyone else like to make comments about this bill?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kopp.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to say I appreciate the bill sponsor bringing this forward. I would note that this body unanimously passed a joint resolution in 2018 with the Senate calling on Congress to align federal and state, you know, penalties with respect to marijuana use. And that's, you know, and this kind of gets at what the bill sponsor is really driving at. We didn't have much discussion on it, but enforcement of this is a real issue. And when you have a double standard, you have an under 19 standard and an under 21 standard, you're dealing with situations where people can walk into a licensed premises to get to the cigarette machine, and they're not there to get alcohol, they're there to get the cigarette machine, or they're going into a mini mart gas station type. Cigarettes are behind the counter. The clerk has to remember, because they got, if you're on the liquor side of the counter, you better see if they're over 21. But if you're grabbing cigarettes from behind the counter, better make sure they're over 19. And sometimes in the gotcha of enforcement, you have staff that just make mistakes, checking IDs all day long. Uniformity in enforcement always makes it easier to have. So an under 21 standard generally, I think, is a good policy. And I just want to touch on what Representative Ledoux said, because I'm sympathetic to impingement on freedoms, very much so. But the one thing different that this addresses that the other risk-taking activities that you mentioned, Representative Ledoux, the thing that is just fundamentally different is the public health crisis surrounding tobacco use. You know, we over 700 people die in Alaska from smoking-related deaths every year. I think we saw it cost the state over $500 million. I know when we were looking at all the data points in the statewide smoking ban bill here a couple of years ago, those numbers all sound right to me. There's a lot of behaviors that people can do that have risk, but the risk is only to them. This is one of those behaviors that affects everyone around you, and no right or freedom is absolute. And this is one of those rights that directly impinges on other people's quality of public health. And in the public health crisis we're in now, I see this as an on-point public health bill that I hear industry, including the people selling the vapes, testifying for. And I think that you know, we can always find a reason to not support it, but I think overall it's a very good policy, and I appreciate Representative Knopp bringing it forward.
Representative Drummond, do you want to?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It's your last chance to comment.
I just wanted to reiterate that I think it's about time we got coordinated as liquor was brought up to same age limits across the entire nation decades ago. Tobacco and vaping products contain highly addictive drugs as well as highly damaging components that I know are going to contribute to the illness of a lot of people in this as this wave of coronavirus hits us. And I'm sure some of those people are going to wish they'd never stopped smoking once this thing grabs them. And I think the earlier we can help protect the public health by keeping kids from getting addicted until they're older and can make these decisions with a clear head, the better off all of us are.
Thank you, Representative Drummond. Representative Stutz, do you want to have any offer any thoughts on this bill? We have closed the public hearing, and we've waived the second hearing requirement, and so we're going to getting close to moving the bill, so Perfect. This is your chance to make comments if you'd like.
Thank you. I would like to make one comment that I noticed immediately. It was really refreshing to see this letter from Juul, a provider of the some of the smoking paraphernalia, if that's what you want to call it, support this. Usually you have the providers or the manufacturers screaming bloody murder, don't do it, don't do it. So that really speaks volumes to me. And I'm really delighted to see the support of the industry in this legislation.
Thank you. And I will just note, as Chair, I actually really appreciate the perspective Representative Ledoux raises about the alcohol, because I'm not old enough to where it's 50 years. When I was in college and I grew up in Texas, you could buy beer and any liquor at 18. And then when I went to college in Colorado, they had this thing called 3.2 beer. So you could get 3.2% alcohol beer if you were 18. But everything else, you had to wait till you were 21. And so I grew up in this age when you could actually have access to alcohol at 18. And I had friends and colleagues that were going and joining the military, and then the age raised, and they could go to war, but they couldn't legally drink, and I always thought that was kind of absurd at some level. But I also saw some of the reasons why the public sort of decided that they like that, and I tend to see tobacco in very much the same way as alcohol. They're public health problems, and I think they... Well, I think there's a good civil libertarian argument that we should have 18 for both alcohol and tobacco. We see the damage that gets done with both products by not trying to restrict some access. And so I think I lean a little more willing to make those limits than I probably did when I was 18 or 19. I would also note that for me, one of the critical parts here is that we have significant substance abuse issues in our communities, and by changing this age, we're actually giving ourselves access to some additional federal funds for rehabilitation and treatment, and I have a hard time not taking steps that help support that. So that's actually one of the biggest factors in my support for this bill, is trying to get that alignment with access to federal funds. So with that, Representative Cobb may have a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move version 31-LS095/K, as in kilo, of House Bill 174 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Actually, Representative Kopp, why don't you try that one more time? I think you left out the 7 after the 5.
Did I? Okay. Oh, I got it there. 3-1, I'm moving version 31-LS0957/K of HB 174. With individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Are there any objections? Hearing no objections, House Bill 174 moves from committee. Let's take a moment. We'll go off record for a moment while we sign the paperwork. Record. And our third and final order of business today is House Bill 287, Village Public Safety Officer Grant, sponsored by Representative Knopp. This is the, I'm sorry, I've been, gotten it right. First hour, never got either of you confused, and then the first time we get to 287 and I get it confused. All right, this is sponsored by Representative Knopp. This is the third hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee, and I know there had been a number of questions, and I do want to note that after floor today, one of the representatives who's not here had expressed interest in having in being engaged in these discussions as we go forward. Obviously, they're not here, so are there questions, comments, thoughts from the committee? Representative Ledoux.
So, is this the bill which would basically be an 80% for government, 20% for the PFD, or is that another bill?
This is the VPSO.
Oh,
this is the VPSO bill.
VPSO bill. All right.
We're going to give 80% of the public safety money to the VPSO program and 20% to the troopers.
I'm just looking
and
at
see if it works better.
I'm just looking at Constitutional Amendment Permanent Fund, POMV, and earnings.
This is 287.
Which is under bills previously heard.
Yes.
Actually, the bill you're referencing, Representative Ledoux, it did not pass out of State Affairs yesterday.
Okay.
So it is not before this committee. The expectation was they would move it. They did not.
Okay. That's my confusion.
All right. Although it was certainly going to make for an interesting intersection. That may be a,
if it's at the appropriate time.
Right. So I actually had some questions that I have for the bill sponsor. I'm not sure whether it, Representative Knopp, it's for you to talk about or whether it's for your staff to talk about. But when public safety, I can't remember which representative public safety, but either the trooper or another from the Department of Public Safety was raising questions, I think in particular about some of the felony provisions in terms of getting approval or getting clearance to serve. So that was one area, and we really had, you know, I mean, they seemed as I understood their comments, they wanted to see some of those felony issues addressed, and that was an area in which they had problems with the bill, and if those were fixed, then they would not have those objections. So can you tell us, give us a little bit more background in terms of the felony provisions, as well as is there a fix, and is that a fix that has support from the Department of Public Safety? And I note there's people from Public Safety on board on the phone. Well, I think Randy Brieger is the person, or maybe it's actually it's Captain Andrew Merrill is the person that was talking most frequently.
Mr. Chairman, may I?
Yes,
speak
absolutely.
Okay,
it's a fairly
you.
Wide.
Yes.
That was a fairly broad question. Open.
Okay. So yes, Mr. Chairman, the question came up about whether or not we wanted the same qualification standard for eligibility to serve as a village public safety officer as any other law enforcement job class, which right now is no felonies. Originally, when we had adopted this language, it came out of a recognition that in many of these rural areas that have the highest incidence of violence and assault and substance abuse in the state, there are some outstanding young men and women who did not come out of that unscathed, but have trust of their villages, their communities. And so we said, well, should we look at a standard that says if you had no sex offense convictions, no crime against a person convictions, such as any assaults or anything like that, but you had a felony, let's say it was a drug possession felony, it's more than 10 years old, or maybe you were importing alcohol into a dry area. Do we want those also to be a lifetime ban? So for, you know, it came up some good, robust discussion, and I think where we kind of finally landed on that is it's just really difficult to have different background qualifiers for these different job classes, and much like standardizing the age of 21 we saw in a previous legislation, it would be easier if we just said no felonies. Will that hit some people very harshly? Yeah, because as we know, not all felonies are the same. We've said, you know, your first time possession of most drugs now is a misdemeanor, and so some of these people will be disqualified just based on that offense alone. But talking with the grantees, they feel comfortable leaving it as a no felony standard, and I'm very amenable to that. It would make it easier, I think, for public safety.
So just for clarity, the existing version of the bill has some felonies are allowed under circumstances, and your suggestion is that we potentially amend this to make it so that the only convictions that would be permitted for somebody to have and still get employed would be misdemeanor convictions.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And Captain Merrill, are you with us?
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, just had to take you off mute.
That's no, we're very patient here, at least sometimes. What is the Department of Public Safety's perspective if we were to work an amendment that made it so that the only crimes that one could have convictions for that would still make it possible to get hired as a VPSO would be misdemeanor crimes and all felonies would be a barrier?
Mr. Chairman, that change of re-including the current language that is in the VPSO regulations of felony convictions being disqualifiers would absolutely be a step in the right direction, and we would support that change.
What do you do about somebody that, say, has a felony conviction for cocaine possession when they were 21 years old that's 15 years old now, and today that cocaine possession would be a misdemeanor? How would that get treated under the regulations today?
Mr. Chairman, so currently under the regulations, that is a disqualifier, so they would not be eligible regardless of when the conviction, if they were convicted of a felony at the time they were convicted, they would be ineligible.
And both for the bill, this is a question both, we'll start with Captain Merrill. Is there a reason that we should try to make provisions that would allow old felonies that are now misdemeanors, that would today be misdemeanors, a basis to still be eligible for employment? Or if it's an old felony, it's an old felony, you're out of luck. Take it, what's the trooper's perspective?
So, Mr. Chairman, from out my side, I'm not a lawyer, so I think we'd have to ask law to actually weigh in on that. But I think the simplest is, for consistencies, if it was a conviction of a felony at the time, then it would be a disqualifier.
Representative Kopp, what's your perspective on that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I agree with Captain Merrill. It's if the conduct was a felony against the law at the time you did it, it would be viewed as a disqualifier. Again, this is it is a delicate area, but I also really listen to not only the public safety perspective, but the grantees, the boots on the ground, and they also would like to have it maintained as a no felony standard, okay, which means a lot to me. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Captain Merrill.
Yeah, so I didn't answer the second part of your first question about just the misdemeanor. So removing the felony is important, yes, but we would still want to make sure that we maintain the domestic violence misdemeanor convictions as a disqualifier for right now, a certain period of time. So we want to continue to work on that to make sure that remains in there.
And I take it, Representative Kopp, that's not a problem for you either.
Brief at ease, Mr. Chairman.
Brief at ease.
With Mr. Truitt, or my team,
Representative Kopp, after you answer this question, will it be easier if you sit with Mr. Truitt so you can whisper?
I think so.
Okay, go ahead and answer this question.
We recognize that the current public safety regulation is no domestic violence assault force within 10 years. So they have a time bar of 10 years on that. So it's not no DV. It's just if it's a misdemeanor DV, it can't have been more recent than 10 years. That's the current regulation, and our bill is consistent with that.
And Captain, well, I'll actually leave it open it to either Captain Merrill or Representative Kopp. Can you identify other issues that the troopers have with the bill that there's been some effort to try to find resolution of those issues over the last few days?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, for the record.
This is fairly open-ended, but what I'm actually trying to do is create somewhat of a record. I know amendments aren't yet due, and so we're probably not considering amendments yet, but I'm trying to at least take the committee down the path of what you've been doing to try to address these concerns and see if these things get done, whether that gets the troopers satisfied.
Well, we may not ever get everybody satisfied, but we're doing the best we can to bring out a good piece of legislation, Mr. Chairman. So other concerns were that the language that sets the standard for good moral character as a minimum qualification for village public police officers, village public safety officers, and probation officers also be applied to every job class of police officers. Certainly this, we are giving this class law enforcement duties, and so a recommendation that actually came to us from Department of Law, which I completely agree with, is to insert language that refers to a person being of good moral character and someone who has not been convicted of a crime of moral turpitude, which is bribery, crimes of deception, fraud, things like that would be moral turpitude crimes. So in light of that, Mr. Chairman, we actually worked on a proposal, which at the right time we'll bring up in front of the committee. So it's the good moral character language. We talked about the felonies already and making it so there's the background standard is the same, no felonies for this job class. We also looked at the language related to federally recognized tribes.
So let's stop. Let's first touch on the moral character topic. Did you have a chance to speak with Captain Merrill or others from Department of Public Safety about the moral character language that you've described?
The only person, Mr. Chairman, I've spoken with is Mr. Skidmore, Department of Law.
All right.
But I have not spoken with anybody at Public Safety Office.
And he's getting a – I'm not sure if he got a pass, but he's not online with us today. Captain Merrill, did you hear the discussion about the good moral character language?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I heard that, and that is one of the recommendations that we had made, and we appreciate that the bill sponsor is considering making amendments at some further date to add that included. That is, we feel, very important to have included. The other one, so on the DV discussion, the one thing that – so DV is very complex because there are domestic violence convictions, even under the current law. We actually had this brought up as part of a discussion among the 10 grantees and the department over the last couple years in regards to hiring an applicant who has a domestic violence conviction. The current regulation actually allows it, and one of the things that we've noticed in the last couple years, we've actually not had any grantees actually hire someone with that domestic violence conviction because of some of the challenges it creates in application in the field. It's similar to what I discussed last week on Friday with felonies, a felon being in possession of firearms. There are certain classes of convictions for domestic violence that are permanent disallowers for someone to possess a firearm or ammunition. And so the challenge becomes we have to look very closely at how a person was convicted and what they were convicted of. Was it a person in the household? Was it a direct family member? So while we in the state have classifications for domestic violence convictions up to the fourth degree of consanguinity, the challenge becomes some of those aren't permanent disqualifiers, and it becomes very hairy to kind of separate those. And so while the current regulation allows it, we have had over the last several years some concerns with that allowance, because if VPSOs move towards being fully capable of carrying firearms, or if a VPSO has been convicted of a disqualifier and we send them to the academy and they participate in firearms training, they could be violating the law, the federal law. And so I think Ms. Kathy Monfreda might be on the line. She's our CJIS person, has maybe a little more information on that. But there are some prohibitors that we would like to maybe continue some discussion to make sure that we're not putting people in a really weird situation that might have those prohibitors. And I don't know that a blanket DV disallowance is the right answer. I don't have those answers, but it's something we definitely need to look at closer.
So we'll get Ms. Monfreda on the line. But so what I'm hearing is that there's a regulation that suggests you can, after 10 years, you could still get hired, but in the field, in practice, no one's getting hired, in part because the difficulty that arises that some DV convictions create a permanent ban on weapons possession, and that makes it almost impossible to hire somebody because it's almost guaranteed there'll be circumstances when under which the VPSO would, if not an armed VPSO, would nevertheless need to take possession of a weapon in the course of their work. Do you want to hear Ms. Monfreda's perspective? Representative Cobb, it looks like you're on the verge of thoughts on this. Let's see what Ms. Monfreda, can you offer a little bit more insight into the into issues regarding the domestic violence convictions and how easy it is to navigate a 10-year period in which somebody can be eligible after 10 years have passed?
Sure. For the record, my name is Catherine Monfreda. I'm the director of the Division of State Rights Services for the Alaska Department of Public Safety. There's been a lot of case law in recent years regarding misdemeanor crimes of domestic violence, and an early U.S. Supreme Court decision in 2006 led to the conclusion that none of Alaska's misdemeanor crimes of domestic violence fit the federal prohibitor. A couple of years ago, and I can't remember the name of the case, that was overturned, and the U.S. Supreme Court ruled differently and determined that some misdemeanor crimes of domestic violence, depending on the relationship between the offender and the victim and the degree of force that's used, could be misdemeanor crimes of domestic violence that are prohibitors under federal law. So probably when the VPSO regulations were written, we were operating under the old rulings from the court system, and that's why they could put in that you, if a certain period of time had elapsed, you could be a VPSO. But under today's law and the U.S. Supreme Court ruling, there is no relief from that prohibitor if you're barred under federal law. And I checked with the FBI NICS people, the National Incident Background Check System people, who are the experts in that, and they confirmed that there is no way to get relief from that disability, regardless of time.
Representative Kopp?
So, Mr. Chairman, this may be a question for Ms. Monfreda. The DV prohibitor, would that be with respect to carrying a firearm in the course of your duties, which I believe it does, but does that also play into the criminal justice information system access, or is that not an issue with DV?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, the prohibitor would be, we would deny the access for the misdemeanor crime of domestic violence from a CJIS perspective, but that could be, they could ask for a waiver of that denial and provide the circumstances and why the conviction should be not be considered a prohibitor. But that doesn't impact the federal possession of or transfer of firearms or ammunition.
So even though they could have access to the database with criminal records, they couldn't take possession of a firearm during the course of their duties and take it from somebody's house back to the VPSO station?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
So, Mr. Chairman, this is one of those issues, kind of like the felony, where we want to find the path that best suits the public safety process the best. There's also Mr. Michael Nemeth online, who is a village public safety officer and a coordinator, and lots of the experience in this area, and we definitely would defer to our team of
So Mr. Nemeth, are you following the discussion we're having with regard to the domestic violence conviction, misdemeanor domestic violence conviction issues, and the federal bar on possession of weapons in relation to that?
I am, Chairman.
So
I actually have.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, it sounds like you've got something ready to go. So go ahead and say what's on your mind.
I actually have a question for the person who is testifying about the CJIS clearance.
Ms. Monfreda.
My question was, yes, Ms. Monfreda. My question was, she mentions the DV prohibitor, but she also mentioned that there are portions, depending upon family member and severity of the domestic violence conviction, that would not be addressed under that federal provision. So I'm thinking it's something like if you had two college roommates who get into a bit of a scuffle, somebody's arrested for it and convicted, but 15 years has passed, that conviction may not be covered under the federal provision that would prohibit the possession or receiving or transferring of a firearm or ammunition. So if possible, I would like that clarified.
Ms. Monfreda, can you draw some distinction between the relationships that create a federal barrier and the relationships that do not,
sure,
under which the 10-year provision wouldn't make any difference?
Sure. Mr. Chair, yes, I can. The federal requirement requires an intimate relationship between the victim and the offender. Mr. Nemeth is right that if it's two brothers that get into a fight, that is not a federal prohibitor. There's a list of specific relationship requirements, including that you have to be an intimate partner, have a child, be married, be the step parent of a child that's neglected or abused. Those are the prohibitors under the federal law.
And I guess the point that you're making, Ms. Monfreda, is that there's four or five categories that are prohibited. There are several other categories that are not. But then when you're trying to decide whether or not the ban is a lifetime ban, that can be fairly complicated for you all to do. Mr. Nemeth, have I got that right, Ms. Monfreda?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We need to determine the relationship of the victim and the offender under federal law, not state law. State law is much more broad as far as domestic relationships go.
And Mr. Nemeth, have you been hiring anyone with DV misdemeanor convictions at all, or has the confusion and challenges to this put a barrier or not effectively put a stop on hiring folks with any DV convictions?
Mr. Chairman, for my organization, for the 18 years I've been a village public safety officer and the 8 years I've been a coordinator, we have not hired somebody with a DV conviction.
Not of any kind.
It has not affected my organization, but I see that if it were one of the ones, a domestic violence conviction that would not fit the federal guideline, like if it were two brothers or two roommates, where it could affect the ability to hire somebody for an organization or even my organization down the road, possibly.
Okay. What are other issues that you have been seeking? I know, Representative Kopp, you've done some amendment drafting. What are some of the other issues you're seeking to address in terms of the amending the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Chuck Kopp, House District 24. Just a few more items, Mr. Chairman. In the bill on page 4, lines 6 and 7, we have reference to federally recognized tribes. And of course, the reason for that is all the grantees, that's what they are. They're federally recognized tribes. They have formed nonprofit entities to partner with the state in delivering of public safety services. But what we found with that language, Mr. Chairman, that was an unintended result is the 229 federally recognized tribes, in fact, we only have 10 grantees, and that obviously raised a level of concern among the grantees, said, do we have enough money for 229 entities to form these partnerships with the state VPSOs? The fact is the entities that want to deliver public safety this way are doing it this way. And so it was not our intent to all of a sudden open this up to all 229 potential applicants. But the 10 tribes that do partner with the state, we want those to stay healthy. We have limited funds as it is. And so our recommendation is just to delete that reference, and that will make it clear that we're not opening up to all 229 tribes. If a new entity wanted to partner with the program, they certainly could. It wouldn't disqualify them.
So the places on page 4 that reference federally recognized tribes, that's an area that you want to remove?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And either Captain Merrill or Ms. Monfreda, if those changes were made on page 4, does that resolve one of the concerns that the Department of Public Safety has raised?
Mr. Chairman, this is Captain Merrill for the record. So in our case, we necessarily didn't have any specific issue with the addition of the federally recognized tribe language. We did highlight that it would make all the tribes eligible. I can tell you that in my experience in operating the program since 2014, I have been approached by individual tribes that were interested in operating the program that weren't eligible because they weren't nonprofits, because they were not happy with the interaction between their village and their tribe and the nonprofit for their region. And so I don't know that we have any concerns with that, but that's just based on my experience. And so we don't have as a department any specific issues with that language either in there or not in there.
What other issues did you look at in terms of a potential amendment, Representative Kopp?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So again, standardizing the background qualifications, the two other ones that I have not addressed are those that deal with possession of drugs, to standardize those. The standard for police officers and for village public safety officers, probation and parole officers, is you can't have possessed illegal drugs within 10 years unless you were under 21. So we had not within 10 years. We didn't. And it was just a drafting oversight. We didn't put unless you were under 21. So we were actually more strict than the other job classes by not having that qualifier that if you were under 21, that wouldn't make you ineligible. And then with possession of marijuana.
So is that a change that you're likely to make in your amendments to make it so that if you're not an adult, that wouldn't be a barrier?
Correct.
And for the troopers, any problem with that, Captain Merrill?
Mr. Chairman, this is Captain Merrill. No, the more closely it resembles the standards for other police officers based on the language that was used in previous hearings saying that we wanted VPSOs to have more authority and more breadth of scope of work, we think it's appropriate that it mirror very closely to what's required in APSC standards.
Brought a question from Representative Ledoux. Representative
Ledoux.
Well,
actually, I was trying to get my question in when we were talking about the tribes.
Oh, go ahead. I apologize for not seeing you. You all have been very quiet, which is unusual.
I said my piece the last bill. So I'm trying to figure out. So if there's a tribe that wants to get involved with this, do we do competitive bidding? I mean, do we do it now, or are we going to do it with this bill? And if you take out the federally recognized tribe, would that not allow for a competitive bids? because I actually think that competitive bids might be not a bad thing, because I know that some of the entities really charge a heck of a lot more than other entities when it comes to overhead charges. So competition is not necessarily a bad thing here.
So through the chair, Representative Ledoux, a couple things you've touched on I want to address to give context. First, for the competitiveness, we fund a finite line item in the Department of Public Safety budget. It's about $11 million. About $2.5 million of that goes to administering the program. So what's left goes between the 10 grantees who develop their budgets, and they have different needs depending on if they have multiple VPSOs, how many communities their VPSOs are serving. Some have a single VPSO. But that money is apportioned based on need. One of the challenges the way it's done now is a lack of transparency in how those decisions are made. The grantees feel like there is no objective standard as to, you know, why a fellow grantee got this much and we got this much, and we don't know how those decisions are made. So that was one of the things that kind of drove this process. You have asked a question about if someone new wanted to get in, can they get in? The answer is yes, they can get in. Right now, they would have to form a nonprofit and partner with the state. If the complaint is, I don't like the nonprofit I was thinking of partnering with or a particular tribe, well, these are all the entities that are necessarily the partners. So it may not work out for that area. And I think by not having federally recognized tribe, those three words in there, you are not stopping any tribe who wants to partner with the state putting together a nonprofit vehicle to do so.
So,
follow up.
Why would they have to put together, though, a nonprofit vehicle? We just heard you on the floor the other day, and you were like really, really eloquent about how we need to recognize tribes, and I voted for that partially based upon your eloquence, Representative Kopp. But now we're saying here that you don't necessarily want to deal with tribes, but we need to go through the nonprofit. So I'm confused.
So through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I appreciate your kind words and your support on that important legislation. Mr. Chairman, I think that Mr. Nemeth, who runs a program, is very well able to explain this, and he is online.
Mr. Nemeth, before you get to that, wasn't there a bill that we heard this year that addressed the fact that Clinken and Haida were not, had a slightly different qualification? Has that bill passed on the floor already? And has that passed the Senate?
It is law now.
Okay, so we actually went through the process of adding one more to those eligible. So before we get to Mr. Nemeth, can you just give me a refresher about what we earlier did, which has to do specifically with the VPSO program and those eligible for being grantees? Because it seemed like we expanded the class by one, but in the process of doing that, I remember some of the testimony was there's only 10 and no one else is interested, or something to that effect.
For the record, Ken Truitt, staff for Representative Kopp. Mr. Chairman and Representative Ledoux, maybe just taking a step backwards, the original intent of the bill of putting federally recognized tribes, couple of things. One,
this is the earlier bill that we've already passed.
This bill.
Okay.
Yeah. This bill.
So first, refresh my memory.
Sure.
I want a refresher on the bill that we passed. I ought to know it perfectly, but I don't. So I want a refresher on what we passed and what that did before we get to this bill, because
certainly. My apologies, Mr. Chairman. To answer that question very specifically, yes, that bill passed last session, and it is currently the law. It added into the statute, and it's in the bill that you see in front of you in subsection B of the reenacted 1865-670 there on, I think it's on page 4. It's the same section of the bill that we're proposing to pull federally recognized tribes out of. It added into the current statute the phrase Alaska Native Organizations, and that has a definition in a different part of the Alaska statutes that Clinkett and Haida was referenced in. So that definition of what an Alaska Native organization is also tightly crafted somewhere else in the Alaska statutes. That's what allowed Clinkett and Haida to be the operator as a tribe under this phrase, Alaska Native Organizations. And I think as the bill drafters, it was Representative Christ Tompkins' bill, if my memory serves, that made this change. The reason they didn't add federally recognized tribes in was precisely because of the dynamic that it potentially could open up this program to all 229, and they just weren't prepared for that.
So Representative Ledoux we'll eventually get back to this bill, but Representative Ledoux, go ahead.
Okay, so in Representative Christ Tompkins' bill, we managed to make an exception for Clinkett Haida to continue to operate, even though it wasn't a nonprofit corporation. So I guess I'm having a hard time seeing why we'd want to amend this so that why shouldn't any tribe that wants to apply for this that says, hey, I think I can do a better job managing this program than X, Y, and Z organization? Because I've represented villages in the past. And sometimes, a tribal entity will think that it can do a better job than their regional association. Maybe they can, maybe they can't. But why not let it be open and let the chips fall where they may?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux. So we're looking at both short-term and long-term goals. This is a short-term, or maybe I should say near-term is better, view of allowing this program to grow under control. Another near-term in the next couple of years is we want to move the VPSO program underneath the Alaska Police Standards Council. But in this bill, it still remains under DPS regulation as it is now, mainly because these are all significant policy lifts. And what the Village Public Safety Officer Work Group did is it focused on those that most had the most immediacy to achieve the most good in a legislative session that is now overrun with coronavirus. So, we're on a short time. You bring up a very good policy discussion, and long term, that is where we'd like to go. But our grantees, the people who we are doing this for rural public safety in rural Alaska, they are very uncomfortable with opening it wide open at this time because we're not going to increase the money available to this program. I think we'll see if it survives. There's another $1 million that was appropriated. But Mr. Chairman, again, I would ask that maybe we allow one of the grantees to comment on this because it is just a policy call.
Mr. Nemeth, I know we've been making you wait for quite a while, but you get an opportunity to comment on this, and I see Representative Ledoux is ready with her follow-up. But Mr. Nemeth, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of want to explain it like this. For our region, we have 13 tribes that my organization represents.
Refresh our memory of your organization and what the region is that you are talking about.
Yes, Mr. Chair. That would be the Aleutian-Pribilof Islands Association and the Aleutian-Pribilof Island Region. So that would cover from the end of the peninsula out to Adak and St. George Island, one of the Pribilof Islands.
Okay, continue.
We have 13 tribes within our 10 communities, and a board member from each of those tribes sits on our board. So we have a resolution through the board that allows our organization to manage the VPSO program for our region. I'm not sure how the other organizations work, but I would think that they also have board members representing their tribes or their tribes have access to the board and would be able to bring those concerns if they weren't happy with the management of their programs to their organization's board to address. I just think we have one organization representing 13 tribes, and We have 6 village public safety officers within those 13 tribes because 3 of the larger communities have their own municipal police departments. But serving those tribes is done through our organization. Say if we had another 20 tribes that applied on their own and were granted funds, it would make it much more difficult to manage the program as 30 grantees than 10 grantees. And I'm sure Captain Merrill could speak to that a bit since he's worked so closely with the 10 of us over the last approximately 5 years. I know it seems like it would be almost an impossible barrier to overcome with that kind of number. So that's just my take on that.
Representative Ledoux, follow-up.
So I guess I would agree that it would be impossible to change it from one grantee to, for example, in your area, to an additional 10 or 15 grantees. But suppose that one of the tribes said, we can run so you structure it that this is a grant for running an entire program in, let's say, the Aleutian Pribilofs area. And so one of the tribes says, and they may say it, they may not say it, hey, we think we could take over this entire program and do it better and do it cheaper. And then the grantor has to look at it and say, well, can they do that? Are they, you know, are the things that they're suggesting, does this make any sense? And just like any other grant. And when I hear you say, Representative Kopp, that the grantees feel uncomfortable holding it open to anyone else, I think, well, if I was a business, for example, you know, I'd want to say if I were like a bar, I'd feel uncomfortable for, you know, having other licenses or something. But that doesn't necessarily mean that other licenses couldn't be a good thing.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux. So again, I would just go back to there's near term and then there's long term. And we are looking at the best near term approach that the grantees have identified that will allow this to grow in a healthy way. You are identifying a future that I think is possible, but and again, I would remind you that every grantee acts like a local public safety department, and the tribes are represented on their boards. Mr. Truitt here was a former VPSO coordinator when he was general counsel to Tlingit Haida, so he ran the program here in Southeast. Their board works just the same way that Mr. Nemeth said his board works. Tribes are represented on those boards, so it'd be kind of like you saying, if the Anchorage Police Department had a competitive bid, wouldn't we allow them? And we actually would not. I mean, we wouldn't, because they're the municipality police department. Tribes, these are long-standing public safety partnerships. It's not like there's, you know, a few people just waiting in the wings to bid on this and say, we want to provide this service. These are long-standing, very well-established partnerships that have been going for many of them for decades. So it's in theory we could talk about that, but the reality is the program is very stable. It's structured like local public safety, and that's the best way I can put it. But I think you're talking about a future that we could open up more doors. But again, I would just say it is a policy call, and this is where the grantees want to be on that issue.
I don't see follow-up. Okay. I suspect it's an interesting question in part because, well, I think there's two sides to that. One is that if the goal is to make it so that it's more competitive, then if we're making some updates to the statute, why wouldn't we put those in place now? And the side to, is it really a worry, the fact that there's a limited number that have been applying for these over the years, I would tend to think the likelihood somebody says, oh, I think there's this new opportunity, and they look at how things are going and they say, oh, well, they're having a lot of struggles with Department of Public Safety. They're having trouble recruiting officers. Who's going to be really excited to jump into the business on the short term? I mean, are we really, even though technically we're opening up the door to many more people to apply, is there a real likelihood that anybody else is going to apply for the grant in the short term or the near term, as you would say? And I guess I would express some skepticism about many people would apply for the grants. I think we would see the same people coming back because, in fact, getting dialed up with that level of resources to run it would be problematic. Representative Ledoux, see, you're all, once you had a little break, you're all on a roll.
And so I guess I would agree with you. I actually don't see that many people applying for the program. But when we look at this program, I mean, the reason why we're here is because this program has so many problems with recruitment, with retention, with just about everything else. So it's not as if we are in this halcyon world where we don't want to change a thing because everything's going so great. And so if some other entity actually had a good idea, and it's always possible, I mean, not likely, but always possible, why would you want to preclude it? That's just my thoughts.
Representative. Mr. Chair, the question's been asked and answered.
All right, that's fine.
I think you're talking about a future that is desirable, but when we opened up the door without giving the grantees an adequate understanding of what that might look like right now, the caution they received is, we appreciate the fact that you want to go that way, so do we, but right now we don't even know what that might look like, and can you give us time to process this?
I would note, my sense from Department of Public Safety was that they don't have a strong position in terms of whether federally recognized tribe stays in or stays out. Okay, so we went down, and I just note for the committee, I think this is all a lot of background that will help us when we get to amendments. It may seem at times that we're kind of having a little bit more detailed work through on the bill than you might see normally in this committee, but this is, I think, part of the effort to try to move this bill forward with some of the limits we have in our time ahead. You touched base briefly before we went back, kind of circled back to federally recognized tribes. We had talked about, you were telling us a little bit about, I think, a conviction issue. What other things do you have on your list?
Mr. Chairman, that just about covers it. We probably, hearing from the Department of Law, they asked for clarity that our intent is to allow village public safety officers to cover multiple villages. That is our intent. There is one section of the bill in AS 1865-670E and F, which seem to require a VPSO for each village in E, but F says, you know, a VPSO could cover multiple villages. So we're looking at language to make it clear that while villages do partner with the state in this program, that it is not our intent that a VPSO not be allowed to go out of a village to a neighboring village 10 miles up the river if that's where the need is. So might look at some language there.
So this is what I would suggest, because we're going to, I think, wind up, unless there are more questions. We should wind up here fairly quickly. We're almost at 3 o'clock. I know you met with Department of Law, Mr. Skidmore. What I would request that your office does between now and our next hearing on this bill, that you also communicate directly with Captain Merrill and share your proposed amendment with him. I'm fully cognizant that at some level the Department of Law should be speaking on behalf of the troopers, but I also recognize that in the way that we sometimes work, it's sometimes very helpful to have the perspective from the troopers. I was working on a different bill, and the Department of Law Criminal Division seemed fairly content, and I was talking to a couple of police departments, and they had some questions, and so I would actually ask that you all coordinate with Captain Merrill so that he's had an opportunity to review the proposed amendment. If there's an additional amendment, I'd ask you to share those and go over them with the troopers as well as the Criminal Division before we take up amendments. Unless there's other questions or comments from the committee, we're going to hold House Bill 287 at this time. And we're going to adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is scheduled for Friday, March 20th at 1 p.m. Given all the topics going on with COVID-19 and legislative scheduling, that is our scheduled time. I can't guarantee whether we will meet or not meet, but I will do my best to keep you advised. If you're considering offering an amendment to House Bill 287, the VPSO bill, please let our office know and submit them electronically by 5 p.m. on Thursday, March 19. I will add additionally on that if you are offering an amendment, I would specifically ask that you share your amendment with the Department of Law and the Department of Public Safety in advance of the hearing on Friday, because I will undoubtedly want to know their opinion of that, because we're trying to get some degree of agreement between the bill sponsor and the Department of Public Safety and Department of Law. And unlike places where the bill sponsor is not on the committee, because Representative Kopp is on this committee, he can offer all the amendments that he wants. So with that, we're going to adjourn, unless somebody has anything else. I don't see anything else. It is now 2:56 p.m. and we are adjourned.